then the cop proceeds to tell us, well, we have this warrant, and, you know, we've already opened the box. And at this point, my mom's looking at me like she could kill me. And I'm freaking out, like, what's going on?
Welcome, everybody, to Drinks with a VC, Episode 5. Thank you for listening and or watching our podcast via whatever channel you were joining us on. My name is Vikram Laquara, and I'm the co-founder of Seed Stage Fund Green Cow Venture Capital. I'd like to introduce my co-hostess with the mostest, Bree Hansen. She runs business development for Berkeley & Associates. Bree, before we begin, you've got two disclaimers for us.
Now, if you don't know our disclaimers by now, shame on you. You haven't listened to our other podcasts, but I'm going to give them to you now. Disclaimer number one, guests and hosts drink on this show, and we ask that if you join us, you be of legal age and you drink responsibly. Number two, if you want to know about check size, stage, similar questions, this is the wrong podcast for you. On Drinks with a VC, we're all about digging a little bit deeper and getting to know the person behind the investment decisions.
So Bree, for months, my wife Laura has been sending me these links to tweets from our next guest and urging me to listen to his message and content, and that it would really resonate with me. And as you know, I had taken some time off of Twitter just as I had the nightly news because of all the vitriol and toxicity on these social media platforms. So I was reluctant to get back on Twitter and check it out.
You and
both. Yeah. But, you know, my wife is right like 99% of the time. And, you know,
99.9.
Yeah. She's clearly the better three quarters of our pairing. But in any case, this time was no exception. And so, you know, a very short story. Here I am at 6 a.m. in St. Louis on January 6th. This is pre-Congress confirming the election results. And I'm thinking it's safe to rejoin the Twitter sphere. And I'm scrolling through Mac's profile. And I was so pumped and excited that my first action back on Twitter was to actually DM him and demand that we hang out and we just have a talk. And I really didn't think he was going to answer me, but he responded like right away. And then we set up some time to chat later that day. And, you know, it was just, it was so crazy because here we are. My face had been glued to the TV and just watching all of the horror unfold and the insurrection on the Capitol. And then 1 o'clock rolls around and, you know, it's time for my Zoom meeting with Mac. And you would think that two brown men getting on a Zoom during this time, that it would elevate our anger. But honestly, it actually subsided and the anger subsided. And Mac was a really calming influence on me at the time, which I really appreciate. And we didn't talk shop that much that day, but what really came through for me was just how undeniably generous Mac is with his time and energy and how dedicated he is to providing value to whatever he's doing, to the person that he's talking to. So much so that when I asked him to be on our show today, he was like, didn't give it a thought. He was just like, yeah, great. I didn't even pitch him on the, you know, the concept. He was just like, great. So here we are. We've got our first real life Twitter celebrity as our fifth guest. He's a graduate of Morgan State University and one of the most genuine people I've ever met in or out of venture capital. He's the founder of Pre-Seed Fund, Rare Breed VC. Also probably has received the longest intro ever, and I apologize to our listeners for this, but please welcome Mac Conwell. Mac, good to have you.
It's great to be here. Wow, what an intro. Hopefully I can live up to that. I don't know if I'm that great, and I'm far from a celebrity. Man, this whole Twitter thing's crazy, but thank you for having me. And one correction, I did matriculate at Morgan State. I did not graduate, But
okay,
still, you know, I went there. I spent 3 years there, so I
perfect.
Most like really successful people matriculated and didn't graduate, so no worries.
I'll take that.
That's true. I think about it all the time.
What are we drinking today?
We
I feel like we've already had drinks.
Bourbon, so making old fashions with blood oranges. So you know, I'm enjoying myself.
Why did you choose the old fashioned today?
It's kind of my go-to drink. Like I am a whiskey and bourbon guy. So when I'm sitting at home and it's been a long day of Zoom calls, I kick back with old fashioned. So it's perfect.
And this time we have a little bit of a twist. As Max said, it's the winter time. And blood oranges are in season. So we figured we'd switch things around a little bit and add that. And it's exciting. These are very tasty and they're going fast.
That they are. But, you know, it's what happens.
Well, did we want to give them the full recipe today or should we move on to our traditional VC unboxing segment?
Yes, we can quickly state In our old fashions, we've got an ice cube with two droplets or dashes of bitters muddled with a cherry and a slice of orange and then poured and then added to that 1.5 ounces of bourbon, maybe 2 ounces, depending on who's pouring, over ice and stirred. And that's what we're going with today.
So one thing I was going to add is for those of you listening at home, if you don't have cherries or bitters or a blood orange, you can just pour a whiskey and drink along with us. That is fine. As many of our listeners know by now, we typically have a running segment throughout our podcast called VC Unboxing, but this one is different. The surprises were already unboxed. Do you want to tell us what happened, Mac?
Yeah, so... I got the scare of my life. I was the other day I was on the phone. I had two young women who were, you know, doing their thing, pitching me on an amazing idea that I thought was actually really cool. And as we were getting to the middle of the pitch and I was about to start asking questions, there's a knock at my door. My mother, who I'm staying with because it's COVID, so I'm here to support her so she didn't have to leave the house, goes to the door and there are two cops there. And the cops identify themselves as being part of the drug and substance abuse unit and then proceed to ask my mom if this was her house and who McKeever Carlo was, which is me, and then ask me if I was expecting a package from California, at which point I told them, not from you. And I haven't bought anything on Amazon recently, so probably not, but what's going on? As I am freaking out, because every now and then I do get random boxes here where, you know, people I know decide to send me stuff or thank yous or whatever. I'm just like, who sent me something? And then the cop proceeds to tell us, well, we have this warrant and, you know, we've already opened the box. And at this point, my mom's looking at me like she could kill me. And I'm freaking out like, what's going on? And that's the point where the cop's like, oh, by the way, nobody's in trouble. I should have led with that. You jerk. Basically, what happened was they had a drug-sniffing dog that alerted them to the box, and they opened it and found my surprises, and then had to deliver the box to me to let me know that they had opened it and gotten a search warrant to do so. So my two surprises have been unboxed already, thanks to two wonderful police who showed up at my front door. Thanks, guys. Right. Appreciate that.
Everything, man. Which now kind of hits me. Maybe the reason there are no sugar cubes is that the sniffer dogs went through them and then just like licked up the sugar cubes. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I probably just didn't find the sugar cubes in the box. They probably actually are in the box somewhere.
They're just loose somewhere. Yeah, I don't know. I just like to point this out. To our listeners or viewers, that the one time that the police choose to inspect a package that is sent by us to our guests, it's with our first ever African-American guest. Coincidence? Sure. But yeah, either way.
I wouldn't want to add that part. You know, we had two white cops show up at my house in the all-black neighborhood talking to me. Yeah. I was really scared. Gotta say,
guys. Yeah. Oh man. All right. Well, not a good look. But let's move on. Mac, your last tweet that I saw was a meme of Dave Chappelle playing
Rick James.
Rick James, sorry, thank you. Dave Chappelle playing Rick James, asking investors to come on, right? It looks like you are having a lot of fun nowadays, which is not something, you know, fun is not typically the word that VCs associate with fundraising from LPs. But either way, is this the happiest you've ever been in life?
Dear God, no. You want to know about the happiest time of my life?
Yeah.
So I said I matriculated at Morgan State. I didn't finish because my sophomore year, I had already had an internship with the Department of Defense that had a top secret clearance. So I dropped out my junior year because Northrop Grumman offered me a bunch of money. So when I was 22 and was almost making six figures and had and still living at home with my mom and had nothing else to do with my money, every Friday and Saturday, I was going to clubs in D.C. and buying two bottles of champagne every night. It was the greatest time ever. Everybody thought I was a football player because I'm a big dude who was just buying bottles and like buying tables and stuff. That was the most fun I've ever had in my life. That was the happiest time in my life where I just had more money than I knew what to do with. And I was in my 20s and stupid about everything. I should have been putting that in stocks. Like if I had to put that money into Amazon, I'd actually be rich today. But, you know, I will say I am enjoying this time in my life. It's a new journey, but I'm at the beginning of the journey, so I'm still fundraising. And like you said, fundraising is not really fun. So we'll get there.
And you make COVID. It look fun.
What years were you active in D.C. in the nightclubs?
So this is probably around 06, 07 time frame.
Okay.
Nice.
Okay.
Nice.
Good times.
Yeah.
My girlfriend, I'm older than you by those dates. And I had a girlfriend who was doing an internship in D.C. and we used to go to Madam's Organ in D.C.
Adams Morgan?
No. There was a bar called Madam's Organ in Adams
Morgan. Adams Morgan. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know what you're talking about. Adams Morgan is such a great place.
Isn't it?
I have... It's not for this podcast, but I have a lot of stories about nice and Adams Morgan. Like,
how do you know that it's not for this podcast?
That's what I'm getting at.
It could be for this podcast.
This podcast is.
I don't know if everybody needs to hear all my drunken nice stories as like a 20-year-old as I'm like in the process of trying to fundraise from very responsible adults.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm thankful that we've all turned that chapter in our lives, right? I've can definitely commiserate with you that, you know, fundraising is awful. And then, you know, and it's not easy whether you're an entrepreneur or a venture capitalist. And that, you know, my 20s were clearly the most fun that I've had from just a purely hedonistic kind of standpoint, right? But, you know, getting back to you, your journey is extremely unique, right? You've gone from working at a crab shack, as we were talking about earlier, to studying computer science, to software engineering jobs at Northrop Grumman and in software IT infrastructure, to consulting, to starting your own company and as a co-founder and an EIR. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how you've evolved as a person, and then the moment in which you thought, hey, I really want to jump on a venture. I really want to be on the other side of the table working with entrepreneurs.
Yeah, so the journey was going to college was I wanted to make money, right? Like I come from very, you know, humble means. And so the idea of I wanted to be at a place where I could be comfortable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually thought I was going to go into engineering and build robots. When I got to Morgan, I didn't know anything about majors, right? I didn't know what majors were what. And somebody told me that's what computer scientists did. I said, sure, that'll be my major. That's not what computer scientists do. They don't build robots, they program robots. But I took my first class and it came easy to me. And then I looked up how much computer scientists made and I was like, well, this is my major. This is what we're going to do, right?
There we go.
And so that was the beginning of that, right? And then, you know, I end up getting an internship at the DOD and the top secret clearance. That was all by accident. So my sophomore year of school, I go to this job fair that's supposed to be for graduating seniors. And I have my resume with me, and I go to every booth, and I give every single person my resume and tell them, I know you're here for graduating seniors, but my resume is better than all of theirs. You should hire me as an intern. I promise you, I will do great. And so I go to this one booth, and this lady comes out from around the booth and talks to me. She's like, look, we're here for graduating seniors, but this is really impressive. You have the right GPA. I run the student program. You know, I think we should talk more. I'm like, great. Never paid attention to who it was. And so a couple weeks later, I get this FS86 in the mail. What is FS86? It's basically a gigantic package to take a background check of the last 8 years of your life to get a top secret clearance, because the booth belonged to one of the three letter agencies that require a top secret clearance. Cool. Didn't even realize it. But what else? We'll do that. And so I get hired into the student program, and that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because in the student program, there's like 300 people, right? Mm-hmm. But of the 300, like 30 of us are Black, right? Now, all the young people who are part of this program were either computer science majors or electrical engineering majors. That's it. Those 30 Black people became my core group of friends through my early 20s. All of us either went to an Ivy League school or a historically Black college or university. That was it. Mm-hmm. It was either Ivy League or HBCU. But these were very intelligent young Black people who were in engineering, who were the same people I would go to DC every weekend to go party with. Like, these were my friends. And within that, there was a young man by the name of Patrick Jackson. And Patrick today is the CTO of a company called Disconnect. It's a VPN company in San Francisco. Patrick was obsessed with being the Black Mark Zuckerberg. Like, he was the first person I knew who built an iPhone. I think he built like an iPhone app in like 06, 07, like in the early days of the iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, he was doing all these things. And because of that, like, a group of us started getting together weekly and talking about tech and what was new happening in tech. We didn't have the right lingo. Like, I didn't know what a startup was. I didn't know what a VC was. But we were engineers who could build stuff. And so the idea of building something that could make money while you slept became a thing. Mm-hmm. And so Pat was the first one of us who quit his job and moved to San Francisco and got funding from a bunch of ex-Googlers, right, to go start a company. And that spurred a bunch of us to want to do the same. And so me and two of my best friends decided to start our first company. And again, like, we still don't have the lingo for it. We don't know what we're doing. You know, the first year and a half of us building that first startup, we didn't know what we were doing. We were literally sitting at home every night. Like, we would go to work and code and then come home and code for like 3 to 5 hours every night. But we weren't getting customers. We were just building every night with no customers. And we did that for a whole year and a half.
Sure. Until
one of our coworkers invited us to an event. And that event happened to be a screening for the CNN special Black in America Silicon Valley, which featured the New Me Accelerator. It was the first accelerator specific for underrepresented founders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we got to meet one of the co-founders of the program there. And we also got to meet some other folks. And one of the people I met there was a woman by the name of Christine Johnson. Christine now lives in Miami. And she was starting this group called DiversiTech, you know, Diversity in Tech, and putting a group in the DC, Maryland, Virginia area to come together. She gave me her card, and she worked at this place called TEDCO, which was like the investment arm for the state of Maryland. I had never heard of it at the time. This is 2011. And then that day, she invited me to the Baltimore Tech Group on Facebook. And that led to me getting to learn about all these other events. And so I started going to events and I started meeting people. And every time I would go to these events, like opportunities would come up. And so my co-founder said, well, you stop coding and just do the event thing that seems to be working. We'll call you CEO and you do that. And so that's how I became a CEO. Have no clue what the hell's going on. And so I start going to events, and then I made up in my mind the stupid rule where if I shook your hand and you gave me a card, I would send you an email within 48 hours and ask you for a meeting. And I didn't know why I was asking these people for a meeting. I didn't know who half of these people were. If I shook your hand, you gave me a card, I was going to send you an email and ask you for a meeting.
Where'd that come from?
And so I don't know. It was just something I figured I was going to do because, like, I didn't know anybody. I didn't know what I was doing. And it was funny because one day I go to this event and this one guy walks up to me. He's like, Mac, you've been networking a lot recently. I was like, I'm not running wires. What are you talking about? He's like, no, networking, like going to events. I was like, okay. Had no clue. Yeah. Right? That's the moment I realized I didn't have a network. Yeah. Was when I started learning what networking was. Yeah. But very quickly, I gained the network locally in Baltimore and became like the hot thing in the Baltimore tech group, in the Baltimore tech scene. That led us to getting into the first Accelerate in the state of Maryland, like Accelerate Baltimore, which still goes today. And then right after we finished that Accelerate, we ended up going to the New Me Accelerator, the one we saw the CNN special about. We were in the third class. And that was life-changing because me and my team spent 3 months in San Francisco, but that Accelerator, every Tuesday and Thursday, they didn't give us any money, right? But they gave one of us a place to live and some food options, right? But every Tuesday and Thursday, we would meet with like advisors in the morning, and we have speaker dinners in the evening. So advisors in the morning are like Aston Most, the first engineer at Dropbox, you know, QA specialist from Google, Marlon Nichols at Intel Capital at the time, right? Mm-hmm. And then the speaker dinners are Eric Ries, Ben Horowitz, Ken Coleman. And like in this condensed 3 month period of time, I gained this network that was far beyond anything I could have conceived of. And that became important for later in my life. So we go through the process of having that company. We ended up pivoting, and then we sell the IP off to a Fortune 100 company. That was great. It's a small exit. I can't disclose it, but I didn't get rich. Don't worry. I started another company after that. I learned how all this stuff works, so I was able to raise the angel round. Cool.
Yeah.
But that company didn't work out because the team fell apart. So
So let me pause right there. You were in San Francisco at NUMMI, but you started. You came back to Baltimore. Whereas a lot of people might have stayed in San Francisco in the Bay Area, where funding is a little bit more abundant, you've got other sort of like-minded, you know, entrepreneurs around you. Why move back to Baltimore?
Because I was broke and I had a mortgage, so I couldn't stay. Like, if it wasn't for the fact that I had a mortgage, I probably would have stayed in San Francisco, and my life would be completely different. But I made the mistake. When I was 23 or 22, I had a six-figure job, three cars, and I bought a four-story townhome in Baltimore that was beautiful. It actually had a floor I didn't use. So like friends of mine would come and live with me for periods of time rent-free because I just had a floor I didn't use. But then later, you know, years later when I started my company and I quit my job, that house wasn't so helpful, so great anymore.
Right.
So that was just, it was just a function of where I was in life. And like, I just had to come home. Like I couldn't stay. Otherwise I would have, which is actually to that point, I actually ended up being the entrepreneur in residence for the next class in NUMMI, just so I could stay in San Francisco longer. So I actually stayed longer than I was supposed to, but I had to come back home.
Okay, so rejoining this, you sold IP to a company for an undisclosed amount. Wasn't life-changing, but okay, you had that exit. What was then the moment where that you sprung back into this the venture mindset and said, okay, I wanna go from starting my own companies to then being an investor and an advisor and a supporting agent in that way to founders.
So that's a weird transition, right? Because every founder, once you start to learn about venture and start getting into it and start raising, every founder thinks they can be a VC. Like we all sure. do. Like it's just like the founder mindset. And so I thought that way myself, right? And I got into, and core to my nature is I like to help people. So I was helping other entrepreneurs raise capital and talking to people about how investors thought. Cause like I spent a lot of time trying to understand how investors thought and why they did what they did. Cause I figured if I could do that, I could be better at pitching because I would be hitting the notes of what they were looking for. And I was helping other founders think that way. But what happened was my second company doesn't work out. I basically go through this period of life for 6 months where I tell people I took 6 months sabbatical. I was basically completely depressed because like having a company fail sucks, right? And I didn't want to see or talk to anybody because like I was always on the scene and networking, going to all these events. And I couldn't fathom going to an event and having somebody ask me, so how's your startup going? Oh, it failed. Right. And so like I had this period of time where like I was in a really dark place. And it took me a while to come out of it. And what knocked me out of it was you haven't paid your bills in a couple months. Do you want us to turn off your electricity or not? And I was like, well, I don't want that to happen. So I need to get back to life. And so I got a job. And I got a job at a marketing firm. And while I was working at that marketing firm, they had hired me originally to be the head of internal products. And so, you know, the CEO had all these ideas and things he wanted to build. And like, now I could be an entrepreneur. I could build cool stuff and make products, but with a paycheck, right? This is great. But essentially, they were a marketing firm for e-commerce companies. So I ended up leading a team of front-end developers and just being the tech lead, which is not what I signed up for and not what I wanted to do in my life. And so as you can clearly tell, venture is nowhere on the scale right now, right? Mm-hmm. Then, and I have a Medium post about this, but this crazy confluence of events happened where I'd been there for about a year. You know, I was just comfortable at that point, but I wasn't happy. And then the day Philando Castile got shot in his car by a police mm-hmm. officer for legally having a firearm, I was just stuck at work. And I couldn't focus. I couldn't do anything. I was just mad. And then all the sterling happened like the next day. And like, I'm on deadline. I got a website to get out. And I can't do anything. That was also the same week I found out that my employer was looking to gain a contract with the National Rifle Association.
Yes.
And it hit me in the worst way. And I kept telling people, like I was telling my coworkers, they're like, look, if we get this contract, I'm quitting. And everybody's like, what are you talking about, Mac? You're not. I'm like, if we get the contract, I'm quitting. I start telling my friends, and my friends are like, you can't do that. Like, even if they get the contract, you need to have a plan. You need to figure out what you're doing next. I know how to code. My front-end skills have gotten way better. So, like, as a full-stack developer, I'm more valuable than ever. Mm-hmm. Like, I've done back-end, DBA, front-end. I know a bunch of languages. I got a skill set. I can get a job. I'm going to quit. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, on a Friday, they rang the gong saying we won the contract for the National Rifle Association. And 15 minutes later, I took my letter up to the head of HR and gave them my letter of resignation. And in the letter, I told them, as a Black man, I could not work for an organization that did work for the National Rifle Association. It became this whole big thing, right? Blew up, you know, all this stuff. And so that was a Friday. The very next Monday, TEDCO, or the Maryland Technology Development Corporation, which is the same place that lady Christine worked at, who gave me the card to introduce me to the Baltimore Tech Group at the time, said that they were hiring a new fund manager. Oh. And so one of my mentors worked there. And so and here's the weird part, right? Like, I never checked my personal email, let alone my personal email at work, right? Like, I gave my 2 weeks, right? So I'm still there. And I see, and I had never gotten an email from TEDCO. I've known about him since 2011. We're at this 2016. I've never seen one of their emails. And so I called up my mentor, a gentleman by the name of Neil Davis. And I said, Neil, you know, I see this thing TEDCO's hiring. Like, I don't really have a background. I don't even have a college degree, any of this stuff. But I know startups. I think I can make a good investor. Do you think I should apply? And he says yes. He's like, we're looking to do things differently. Should give it a shot. I was like, okay. And so I left that job and I didn't apply to another job. For the next 4 months, I went through the hiring process with Tedco. And when it was all said and done, I'll never forget this because this has never happened to me before. They put an invite on my calendar to take me to lunch. And I'm freaking out, like I've never had anybody take me to lunch. I'm like, this can't be a letdown, right? They're not going to take me to lunch to say no.
To say no.
And so I show up and there's the CEO and the senior vice president. And he starts off like, so I want to let you know, Mac, you don't have the experience for the job. So how they started off. I'm like, well, why the hell are we here? And then they said, but we really like you and we want to have you on the team. So we're creating a new position and want to know if you're willing to take this. They literally created a junior position to bring me on staff. And I said, yes. And so that is how I got in the venture, right? Like it's like one of the worst things that had happened to me in my professional career led to me getting into the career that I never thought I would have. And it's my true calling. Like I love what I do.
There's a lot of serendipity and, you know, good things come to good people. So hear, hear to that. Let's remember this is Drinks with a VC. So hopefully we can raise a glass and salute you to that.
So I love that you just shared your story with us. You know, I know that you shared your story kind of starting at your career point. I kind of want to go back to your humble beginnings. If I asked a lot of my VC friends what their greatest accomplishment was to this point, none of them would say making it past 25. And that perspective doesn't really exist here in the Valley or in any other investor circles. Can you talk a little bit about your reality as a Black man from Baltimore and venture, and what does success look like to you?
Look, I mean, growing up in Baltimore, my parents did their best to shelter me, right? My dad was a postal worker, former military. My mom was a bank teller. But I mean, I was around people and some family members that were into stuff, right? I went to a high school that's actually in Baltimore County, the nicer parts of Baltimore, where my first week of high school as a freshman, I saw a young lady walk down the hall. She took two razor blades out of her mouth and proceeded to start cutting another woman. And then the young lady she cut stopped and said, B, did you just cut me? And then proceeded to beat her up. The woman with the razor blades lost the fight. And that's when I saw the police officers who were in my school come and break the fight up and slam both of those young ladies on the ground. First week of high school. That is the school I went to. You know, most people know, like, if a fight broke out in school, that was, like, a big thing. Like, fights in my school were, like, a regular daily thing. Riots happening at the school was a big thing. We've had, like, one riot a year. Like, that's when we had big stuff. I know people or grew up with people who you would call gangsters, thugs, shooters, killers, right? It happens. You know, I know people who have, like, succumb to the streets, who are drug addicts, who are in jail for the rest of their lives, who have been killed. One of the guys I played football with, sister, got shot in her car because her boyfriend was doing a drug deal that went bad. Huh. Right? That's just the reality of it. And again, like, I had both my parents. And here's the weird thing, right? By the time I was in fifth grade, I recognized that having both of my parents was weird. I was one of the few people in my classes that could say that. And I went to a high school where my incoming class had over 600 students. Less than 300 of us graduated. Of that, less than 5% of us went to college right out of high school. Right? Like, that's the reality. I've spent time in my life post-high school where I was homeless. I lived out of a truck for months at one point where I would, like, go to friends' apartments to take showers and things like that. Or at work, I would like wash up in the bathroom in the sink and try to go back to work. Like those things happen. So success for me is never being homeless again. And I'll never be that again. Like, no matter how bad I could fail in life, I know a pathway forward. Like, even if this venture thing, let's say I become the worst VC ever. Every company I ever invest in goes straight to zero. I'll never make any money. Like, I'm just horrible at this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll find a way to get a job. I'll find a way to make money. I'll do what I have to do. You know, I've worked at Crab Shacks. I've worked at Popeyes. I've worked at a mechanic shop, right? Like, I've done yard work, like, whatever. I've done construction. Like, when I was in high school, I had an uncle who would get up in the morning, and we'd have to be at the spot by 6 a.m., and a truck would come by. And whoever got into the truck first could go to the job site for the day, and at the end of the day, they give you $100. And I did that for a summer, you know, doing construction with my uncle. So on the back of a truck, at the end of the day, you get your $100, going about your day. But these are like 12-hour days. That $100 wasn't anything compared to the amount of work. But for me, like, hey, you know, this is money. Right? So success for me is, you know, I'm still alive, right? And I'm able to make a living, and I'm moving towards something I never considered. And I just say, when I was an entrepreneur, that was the other life-changing thing, was understanding the options in life. Nobody ever told me I could apply to Stanford or Harvard or Oxford or University of Tokyo. Nobody ever told me that how you make money with stocks, or that there were people who invested in salt mines and copper mines. You know, that there was all these different ways to make money and to live, and these experiences. And so that was the moment I realized, like, I could try and do anything that I wanted to. And I make it a point to instill that in my friends. You know, I had a friend who told me he wanted to go to business school, and he mentioned he was going to go to business school, the same place he got his undergrad. And I was like, well, you're going to apply for Stanford and Harvard, right? And he just looked at me, because he never considered it. And I was like, well, if you're going to go to business school and get an MBA, you might as well go to a top three. He's like, do you think I could get in? I was like, why not? What makes you different than anybody else? And so just that piece, right, never resonated with me until I was around all these other people. Because, you know, when you go to these accelerators and you get into these startup communities, you meet people from so many, from backgrounds so different from mine.
Sure.
Right? And so that was incredible. And that's one of the things that empowers me to, like, just try to do stuff that I do now. Like, the idea to quit my job and just try to raise a fund didn't make sense. I mean, it made sense in the fact that I had studied to be an investor, but it didn't make sense. Like, I still didn't have that network, you know? I don't have a bunch of money in the bank. Like, I tell people I'm a broke VC because I spent the last 4 years working for the state of Maryland. Like, I didn't make money. I don't get economics out of that.
Right.
I don't have a financial windfall, but what the hell? Go try it.
So. Yeah. So much about pre-seed investing, which is the stage you're at, is about investing in the team, the people, right, behind the ideas. We talk a lot about how different perspectives and unique perspectives build the best teams. I definitely believe adversity brings and builds the best teams. When you're out there in the market and you're looking to make investments and you're looking at co-founding teams, what are the you know, facets of the team or the founder that really appeal to you the most, right? That stick out to you the most, that you look for and search out the most?
Founders who are thinking very critically and uniquely about customer acquisition, experience, and retention. Like, one thing that I learned, and this, you know, colors everything that I do, and I'd say this, like, this thought process really comes from the early days of 500 Startups. And so feel however you want to feel about Dave McClure and Paul Singh, you know, two of the founding members. You know, they both have their issues, right? But when it comes to startups and understanding and evaluating startups, both of those men are really smart. And I'll never forget when I started my first company. So Paul Singh is from the Maryland, Virginia area. And I ran into him in a few places. And every time I would talk to him, he would always harp on, you know, this thing about customers and everything you do needs to be about customers. And it's not that, you know, we need to do something else. And really what he was getting to was, if you don't know how to get customers, it doesn't matter about all the stuff, other stuff. It doesn't matter how great what you're building is and all these strategies. Every day, the most important thing you need to be thinking about is, how do I get more customers on this platform to generate more capital? And really, that customer acquisition mindset is so critical. And so one of my top performing companies out of my previous portfolio in the state of Maryland, and I found I'm fairly close to, it's this young man by the name of Femi. He's the CEO of a startup called Skylarme. When I met Femi, he was a 17-year-old kid in high school. And I'm at this incubator, and like it was me and like one of my teammates was giving a talk. It's a small incubator in Baltimore County. And this young kid's there talking about he's a growth hacker. You know, he's had two companies and he sold one. And that, you know, he's looking for clients and he can help anybody get customers. And he's this young black kid. And so I talk to him, I get to know him, I stay in touch with him. And, you know, this is some arrogant stuff to talk about you're a growth hacker at 17 and you know, sold companies. Like, what are you talking about? And so he goes, you know, he eventually goes off to college. And like, for like, oddly enough, like he had gotten these three different colleges to agree to let him spend different times at each one to get to one degree. And like this kid's like, what? Like, he also gotten so much money in student loans that he was actually like getting paid to go to college. Like, it was crazy. So I stayed in touch with him. One day he's like, you know, Mac, I got an idea. I'm creating this common application for scholarships. It's a terrible idea. They'll never make money. Don't do it, folks. And I'm like, sure, kid, you know, tell me. Like, I'm thinking to myself, like, well, you just got into college. You just got all this money doing scholarships. It's a pain point personally. Like, you fix what you know. I get it. It's kids do, right? It's what people do. And then he tells me he got 25,000 users in his first 3 months. And he gets scared when I tell this story because he's afraid he's going to get in trouble one day. Because he basically figured out a hack on Venmo, where through the API, he could find high school level individuals. And he would send a group of young people a penny on Venmo with the message to say, here's money for college. If you want more, check out Skylarme. Now, that ain't the smartest thing I've ever heard. Like, I didn't care about anything else up to that point. And then his co-founder, who was a friend of his, was a micro-influencer on Vine. They had a whole community of other micro-influencers, and they would, like, come up with strategies to get tweets and Vines to go viral, to get more people on their platform. Like, who are you kids? And so I literally, like, begged my team to give these kids 40 grand to drop out of college and, like, build a company. You know? Like, I don't care about anything else. Like, yeah. Things like that are amazing, right? But then on the flip side, I'll give you a founder who's completely on the other end of the spectrum, a gentleman by the name of Chad, who runs a company called RemodelMate. An interesting thing about Chad's a little older. Like, Chad's around my age, right? And so I saw him pitch at this event, and, you know, he's trying to talk to these investors, and I pulled him to the side. You know, this young black man, you could tell he's getting new in the space. They've been only up for 3 months. And I explained to him what being too early means and, you know, what early stage investors really invest in. Like, early stage investors have nothing to do with, like, the stage of your business. It's more the stage of your revenue, right? You got to understand, like, that's the hard thing for founders to understand. When I tell you he cussed out me and every VC in the industry, he was so mad. But I understood because, like, I was him one day. Like, there was a day when I was him. And so it didn't bother me. Like, he's not really mad at me. He's mad at the situation, right? He's trying to build this company. He thinks getting money is going to save him. It's not how that works. And so I kept telling him, like, yo, you just got to build business. And so I just watched him for 18 months. And at some point, he went dark on me. He stopped talking. So, like, I ran into him at an event, and I was like, dude, you know, how you doing? He's telling me, you know, his company's doing well. He's doing more than $500,000 in GMV. You know, something impressive. And so, like, I'm trying to ask him, like, well, what did you figure out? And he figured out that he would market to people around certain stages in their lives. And that was just smart as hell. I never heard anybody in his space say that. And so not only did he figure something out, not only did he have the hustle, but he's being smart about his customer acquisition. And then on top of it, like, he's like the partner getting king. Like, he was getting partnerships left and right. You know, this is a company less than a year old. He's got a partnership with SoFi. Like, how the hell did you pull that off?
Right.
And he's gotten so many partnerships, and like, they come and they go. He's like, if it doesn't add value, I can get rid of it. But the way he thinks about his customers and supporting his customers, man, he had one woman where they did a job. They put in a new bathroom in her house. And when they did it and they tried the water, there was no hot water. And so they recognized there was something wrong with the hot, that something was wrong, something was broken. And so they went ahead and personally fixed it. So it'd be ready, because she actually went on vacation. So the bathroom would be ready when she got back. And so they went ahead and personally fixed it on their own dime and left her a note and let her know, like, hey, we took care of all this and everything. Because they thought that maybe something they had did was wrong. She came back and was like, oh my God, I haven't had hot water for 3 months. I've been needing to get that fixed. Thank you for taking care of this. You're amazing. He ate the price for that. And at the end of the day, he was just happy he had a customer that was satisfied with the work he did. Who's not backing that founder? And right. The answer is a lot of people.
Right. Yeah.
And that's why I was happy to be the first person to ever say yes. And the crazy part is, we said yes from the state of Maryland and gave him 40K. He leveraged that to close another 500.
Wow.
Because all these other investors were just sitting on the sidelines watching them.
Mm-hmm.
How do you not back a founder like that? Like, yeah. he's not going to stop.
You mentioned, you know, back then that your founders really understand their customer pain point. Obviously, at Berkland, we're outsourced CFOs. That's all we talk about is product market fit, really understanding the pain points. What are some pain points that you want to see solved in 2021?
So if you follow me on Twitter, like, I'm big onto the hair care space, because mm-hmm. but on the physical product side, like, everybody's looking at consumables, the creams and the oil, because everybody wants to find the next shea moisture, right? But when you think about it, and if you ever walk into a hair shop and you look at, like, the tools, the physical tools we use, they're the same things that have been there since we were kids.
True.
Like, most of the brushes on the walls when you go to Target or Walmart, the same brushes that have been there since you were a kid. You mean to tell me there's nothing we can innovate on?
Up to the brush.
So there are some entrepreneurs out there doing some really unique things in that space. And so I'm excited to see stuff like that. But, like, industries like that are appealing to me, because my big thing is, and one of the driving forces in the way I think about, because people ask me, like, well, you're a generalist, you're so broad, how can you be that broad? I'm like, well, because I always come back to that customer acquisition piece. I don't care what you do. I don't care what industry you're in. If you can figure out that piece, I can ride with you, because we can figure everything else out, because I never want to be the investor who misses out on Spanx.
Sure.
Like, I never want to be that investor. And it's so easy for your own biases to get in the way. Like, I understand as a former operator, I can connect with entrepreneurs, right? But being a former operator also means I have additional biases about the industries I specialized in that are probably going to stop me from investing in the right company at some point, because I know so much about those industries. I know all the good and the bad. And so it gives you a far more critical eye than I probably need. Because as investors, we also know a lot of this stuff is about timing. So things that didn't work 10 years ago may work today.
True.
Like, these industry changes over time. And so I have to spend a lot of time getting my own biases out the way. The easiest way for me to get away from that is talk to me about your customer acquisition. If you got a good plan, you're growing right, you're doing the things you're supposed to do, okay.
And just for the audience and the listener, that's Rebundle Co. Is that right? I know you're not pushing it, but I do follow you on Twitter, and we, you know, want to give you a chance to give a shout out to your favorites.
Rebundle Co. It's a cool one. I like Rebundle. Yeah. I like Sledge Sharves. Sledge is dope. Okay. Devaneering Labs. That they're in stealth mode, but you're going to hear some stuff from them hopefully this year. So, you know.
Yeah.
Those are all in the hair care space, and, you know, some others I'm looking at, but, you know, and I'm not, just caveat, I'm not an investor in any of those companies yet.
Sure.
So, you know, may be in one or two of those in the near future, but not yet. So just a caveat, just I'm just a fan, right?
Yes.
And that's the other thing, like I'm going to meet more amazing entrepreneurs than I can invest in.
Yeah.
I still hope that I'm able to help some of those entrepreneurs along the way. Because sure. At the end of the day, if I only help the entrepreneurs that I invest in, then what am I really doing? Like, that doesn't resonate with me as a person. Like, I'm building a community, and so I want that community to be supportive. Because there are going to be other companies that deserve to be supported that I'm just not going to have enough money to invest in. Like, I'm raising a $10 million fund. I'm not there yet, right? So I can't invest in everybody I see. Like, if I had a $100 million fund, it'd be a different story.
No, I think that is a fundamentally what differentiates the really amazing, fantastic venture capitalists from the you know average venture capitalists is an ability to provide value pre-check to everybody, whether they you know end up investing or not. And so often I think everything in venture is labeled out to be some meritocracy, but within all of this, there's failure and there's tons of it. And, you know, show me a founder that hasn't failed or pivoted really hard. That's gone on to be successful. It's just very few of them. So I think if you're not contributing even to folks that, you know, maybe don't have the best idea or, you know, need, as you were relating earlier, just don't have the same foundation that others have to kind of give them that perspective to say, hey, this is how you should be looking at it. You know, you're not doing something wrong. You just don't know what you don't know. And I think that's a really powerful point that you bring up. Is there a place that you want to be with Rare Breed VC? You know, I know you're backing and you want to back founders across the United States, right? Is there a particular background of a founder that you're looking to back? So I'll be point blank. Are you only looking at African American founders? Are you more drawn to people that, you know, aren't the typical, right? The overlooked per se.
No. And I think that's the point. The point and the goal is to be an investor that invests truly in the best companies, no matter where they are, no matter mm-hmm. who they are, no matter their background. I do understand the need to invest specifically in women founders, underrepresented founders and such, because there needs to be a course correction. Right. Mm-hmm. But I aspire to be the VC that every other VC says they are. The mm-hmm. VC that truly looks at the meritocracy, that looks across the board, right? That sees all the amazing entrepreneurs. Because also at the end of the day, the job, my job, and what I get paid to do is to take other people's money and make them more money. That is my job. And so if I was to meet Mark Zuckerberg and he comes to me and says, hey, I'm building the Facebook. My job is to invest in that. If yeah. that's going along too. But it's also my job that if I meet Sarah from the woman who started Spanx, she's like, hey, I'm building the next generation corset. It's my job to invest in that too. Right? Like yeah. that is my job. My yeah. job is to invest in the best companies, no matter who they are. And so that's the goal.
So a lot about investing, particularly in the environment that we find ourselves in right now, you know, of the pandemic, is looking at new use cases that are being created every day. You know, one of the problems today on a lighter side is that we don't get to go out and pay homage and tribute and give money to restaurants and purveyors around us. We do have one box in the VC unboxing that was not opened. That is a surprise. We'd love for you to take that out right now and tell us what's inside.
Okay, let's see what's in this box. This is a fairly large box too, so.
It is.
I thought this was the one that the drug sniffing dogs would have somehow gotten their noses on, but apparently it was the other one. So
it was the other one. It was the other one. Although, and there is some irony in the box that they did open.
It's a complete irony. Yes.
We'll get to that.
Place. I think everyone will know why the dog opened that box soon enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. It's a bizarre irony. I wonder if the police were thinking the same thing when they saw it. Were they like, wow, Fido really knows.
Yeah, Fido really knows. It wasn't the sugar cubes after all. Absolutely.
So what is this? The crazy thing is, it's a rice cooker, steamer. I used to have one. I think my cousin took it from me when she got married. I have missed having a rice cooker so much.
Yes.
This is awesome.
Fantastic. Wow. What else is in that? And I know there's more.
That's wow. Okay, so there's another box that's more tape from. Okay,
so he's like, right, what weirdo.
I dropped the box. Be careful. Okay. It would be really terrible if I cut myself with this.
Yes, please do not. That'll be our first emergency.
Pull some razor blades out of my mouth and open them for you, you know?
Oh, yes.
Hey, that I knew people who would like walk around like practicing that kind of stuff. Like,
it's like you went to prison for high school.
I used to tell people that like I was in the gifted and talented program, so like we were separated from general population. Like, you know, we're separated from general population. Like, I used to always use that joke, so you know that was appropriate. Okay, what's going on here? All right, so we got some seaweed for sushi. They got a complete sushi making kit. Okay, this is pretty awesome.
We know you like sushi.
This is pretty awesome. There's a complete sushi making kit. Wow,
love it.
So now I have to make sushi like tomorrow. Like, this is going to be a thing.
I got Nick live lobsters for his birthday, so, you know.
Live lobsters are amazing, but, I mean, granted, I do read, like, a lot of Japanese and Korean and Chinese comics, and, like, I am, like, I actually subscribe to this company called Tokyo Treats, where I get a box of treats from Tokyo.
Yes.
So, like, this is, like, right in my wheelhouse.
Right in the alley. Absolutely. Man.
That is amazing.
I love that you have the biggest smile right now. It's very much akin to the fact that, yes, when Ren and Bree got me these live lobster, I had the biggest smile on my face. It was also like a what the fuck moment, because I really had no idea how to cook a live lobster. And
YouTube, and YouTube is great for things like that.
And I needed to do it fast because my fridge is small. You've got time, because nothing is like super perishable there. It's all like on demand as you need it. But yeah, as Bree was saying, we know that you have a love affair with Asian culture, whether it's the cuisine or the comics or the martial arts. Our biggest question is, growing up in the environment that you grew up in, what led to that love affair? When did you start?
So this is funny, right? So growing up, this is like what actually precedes everything that leads me down this path. I had to be like 5 or 6. And on the Sci-Fi Channel, there was this anime that used to come on, Macross.
Okay.
Which is... And like there was, and it's really a show about like cultural exchange and stuff. Mm-hmm. But really, what got me was they had these fighter jets that transformed into robots. Mm-hmm. Or Robotech, that's what they call it. Robotech. Macross is like the larger name, but Robotech. And so I became obsessed with military fighter planes and one day wanting to build a fighter plane that would turn into a robot.
Is that like, what you did at Northrop Grumman?
No, not even close. But like, as a kid, people would ask me, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would say, I want to be a military aircraft developer.
Wow.
Because I wanted to be a pilot first and then realized I hate heights, I don't like roller coasters, and I have bad eyesight, so that's not going to work. So, like, I could build them. And so, like, Robotech was, like, the beginning of my love affair for, like, Asian culture and engineering. So
I think we can all relate to watching Robotech when we were kids and being fascinated by it. We had Transformers, right, with Shia LaBeouf.
Yes. Transformers was a great cartoon, by the way. Love that show.
It was great.
So thank you so much. This is truly, truly generous, and you guys went all out.
So thank you. Should we show what came in the other box?
We can show them what came in the other box.
Should we show them the thing that we think that the dogs were after?
So this is the other box. It's labeled DB. And when you open it, there is a Yeti dog bowl that is personalized for my dog Zeus. That is amazing. Thank you. Zeus is like excited about this, but I wouldn't be surprised if this is what the police dogs are looking for, which is incredible. And next, they got me a box that's labeled these. And so this was dope. And this is going to be like a collector's item one day. Patagonia vest with our rare breed logo, which actually, we don't actually have a logo yet. This is like a placeholder. So this is going to be like a one of a kind, like artifact that everybody's going to wonder about. But now I've never had one of these. So now I feel like a real investor now. Like it's real. I have one of these vests now. Like it's a thing.
That's all you need, really. It's just the vest at that point.
It's all about the vest.
Yes. What inspires someone to name their corgi Zeus?
I don't know. It was a good name.
Yeah.
It was just a really good name.
Do you like mythology?
I did like mythology growing up stuff, but I was thinking, like, what would be the most ironic name I could get a tiny dog? It was like Zeus.
Zeus, right? Yeah. Like, I was literally at a dog park, or walking by a dog park. I don't have a dog, but walking by a dog park in San Francisco, and someone called out Zeus, and I was looked around, expecting a corgi, because we had done so much background in UK, and it was a mastiff, and I looked at him,
yes,
that is more what I would call a dog, Zeus, or yes. Right? That makes a lot more sense to me.
That makes a whole lot more sense, but. But my Zeus has a ton of personality. So, like, he doesn't know he's a little dog. He thinks he's giant. So, you know.
Fair.
So, I actually have a question here that it's kind of funny. This is a good transition. So, I once knew a billionaire who called himself Zeus. Okay. He sat on the top of Hollywood Hills, Sumner Redstone. He died last year. Sorry, Sumner. 2020. Here's to you. But how this translates into my question for you is, what I've learned is that every billionaire has an obsession. They all have a way that they've earned their money in order to create some new reality, or they have, you know, and I know you've got your eye to have the ability to do anything and have options with wealth. So if you were a billionaire, what would be your obsession?
I buy up a bunch of land in the middle of the desert, like somewhere in Nevada, and create the most amazing series of racetracks and have my own racing league, because I love to drag race and drive cars fast. So that would probably, I'd build, like, you know, UFC has Fight Island. Yeah. I'd have Racing Island.
Mm. mushrooms. That would be really cool in Nevada, actually.
Have you could... done... Sorry, Brie. Have you...
Go ahead.
No, Mac, have you done, you know, racing and have you tried that out around a track? Or is it more like what I've had experience with, which is driving fast on, you know, the 57 from Santa Monica to, or not Santa Monica, but in Southern California, you know, at 135 getting pulled over by the police.
Yeah, after getting, you know, two or three tickets for street racing and going really fast on the road, you decide to make it legal and go to the track. So yes, okay. I used to go to drag strips and like I used to, you know, race my car and stuff like that, mod cars. I used to tell people that when I was younger, if I knew when I was younger what I knew then, I would have been all about cars, and that's just what I would have been. I became a race car driver. So yeah, that would be my obsession, a bunch of really fast cars kind of thing.
So Mac, somewhere scattered in all of the different jobs that you've had, you are a former gamer.
Yes.
What did you play first of all?
So when I say I was a former gamer, I wasn't professional. Like, this is like, in the early 2000s when the thing, like, yeah, professional game wasn't the thing yet, right? But for me, I played a lot of Madden.
Okay.
I played a lot of Soul Blade, which is now Soul Calibur.
Yes.
Tekken. So yeah, I'm a huge fighting game guy. Mm-hmm. And I love RPGs. So okay, Final Fantasy VII was like, well, Pokemon's probably my first RPG, right? Sure. But Final Fantasy VII was like my first real RPG, and like, it's hooked. It's like playing a storybook, right? Like, it's the greatest thing ever. I miss turn-based RPGs. All this like actual running around and pressing buttons and stuff. It's right, too complicated. I want to strategize and have time, decide what I'm attack with.
Yeah.
I miss turn-based RPGs. But yeah, those were my go-to. Yeah. I used to actually play like, so Soul Blade was actually my uncle's game. So I would like spend like whole days over my uncle's house, and we would play that game all day for hours. And then he would take me into the city in Baltimore City, and we would go to this video game shop, and we would play in tournaments for money. Yeah. And like, we would crush people. Yeah. Me and my uncle would crush people. Yeah.
I mean, I loved the unrealistic size of the swords in that game. Like, it was, yes, just like, there's no, you know, I would sit there, and of course I'm playing, and I was addicted to playing Soul Calibur and Soul Blade, etc. But I would find myself kind of like going off to nowhere and just thinking like, but man, that sword would have to be really fucking heavy, and there's no way in hell they'd be able to wield it like that. Like, I don't know. Maybe
that's how I am with movies, right? When you start seeing stuff happen on movies, like, come on, like that's, yeah, it's like physically not possible. Like, the physics here do not make sense. I can never turn my brain off during movies. Like, like certain movies is just like, why are we here? Like, this can't do this. Like, cars don't jump like that. Granted, no matter how crazy you are, any movie in the Fast and the Furious series,
yeah,
doesn't matter how crazy it is, how realistic it is, doesn't matter. It's about cars going fast. I'm all about it.
I'm with you on that. Do you like kind of the Shaw and Hobbs kind of turn that they've taken now?
So when those movies started to come out, and they got, once they got past like 6 or 7,
yeah,
I was at this point in my life where I had this career where I just didn't have time for movies. So I'm just so far behind on movies. Like, I want to see that movie so bad. Like, there's all these movies I want to see, but like, I just never have this time for it. Like,
yeah,
I'll just stick to my comics. I read like 2 comics a night, and that's my free time.
That's fantastic. Speaking of video games, GameStop, for all the old school gamers out there, you know, Reddit caused quite the storm, and you've got the short squeeze on. What's your take on GameStop? And then, do you actually think that this is just delaying the inevitable, like, you know, the Titanic is going to sink? Or do you think that GameStop kind of gets revitalized somehow, and they pivot in a way that makes them kind of relevant?
I love GameStop. It's somebody who used to be a gamer, like being in GameStop is like going into a time warp and like reliving my childhood, right? Like it's amazing. I don't think it's delaying the inevitable. I think it's giving them time to transition into whatever the next version of what GameStop is going to be. It's probably going to be far less storefronts, and they're going to become far more of just an online presence, right? And I think we're going to see this across, like, we're going to see shopping experiences change over time where you're going to have physical locations where you go just so you can touch and feel and try products, but you're still, but fundamentally, you're going to make your payment choices online.
Also returns.
Yes, and also returns. But, like, you know, I do believe we're going to get to a point where you're going to have stores where only have like one or two, or I have one of every item in every size just for people to try, but you're not actually going to purchase from the store. Like, I do see a world where something like that happens. And so, you know, I think GameStop's going to transition to something more like that. Where somewhere you go, maybe try games, you get the expert opinion, but then the bulk of their business happens online, and you know, it makes sense.
So we have a new administration. And I'd like to think that even in our infancy as a podcast, that we have someone from the Biden administration and team that's listening here. What is the one hope or piece of advice or wish that you have for the administration over the next 4 years, but particularly now and then the first 100 days, et cetera, that you might have for Biden?
Selfishly, let's change some of these credit and investor rules. Let's allow for more LPs and funds. Let's allow for funds to be able to crowdfund, right? Let's change some of this stuff so that we can get more people into the asset class of venture capital. Because opportunistically, I'm in the process of raising funds. So y'all help a brother out, please. That's why I was saying selfishly, what do I hope the Biden administration does is, I don't know, because here's the thing, right? At the end of the day, there's not many things that a president's going to do that's going to affect your daily life. The people who have more effect on your daily life are your local government, your city councils, right? Your local judges. Most people don't even know who their local judges are, but you voted for them, or you just skipped over it, or you just checked box, you just checked on it because they had an R or a D next to it, right? Like, those are people who really control what happens to you in your day in, day out life. I think my wish and hope would be for people to take more care into understanding who all of the representatives that we vote in the office are and what they do, right? When we talk about we want, you know, prison reform and, you know, police reform, everybody's looking at the federal government to do that. But locally, you have the power to do that too, and can happen much faster and affect your local community. I want people to think, to stop thinking that the federal government is the solve all, because at the end of the day, we are the United States of America, and we were created in the system where individual states have specific powers that keeps the federal government from overarching or overreaching everything else. So that means that is what we were founded on. Now, the federal government's power has grown over time, and I actually think there's some benefit to that, right? But locally, still, if you want to change things, get people out of office. Stop voting for people. You'd be surprised how quickly people's politics change when they realize their jobs and livelihoods are on the line. And the type of politics and things that you can get past because of that could be really powerful. And so I want people to think more critically about the not polit about the political system around them and how it works. sure. from a local standpoint, and stop looking to one person, the president, who has a ton of checks and balances to saving us. Like that's not how this country was created.
Sure.
And I don't think enough people understand that.
Yeah. I would say that, you know, just I feel like a lot of America and our citizens are naive to that fact. And it's not until, you know, people start questioning the change of power between presidents and administrations that they start understanding, oh, what are all of the different processes that need to happen for that to occur? Then they start understanding where everyone's kind of place is and what decision they can make that affect them. And I think we're starting to see, just with POTUS announcing certain things and then governments and states kind of counterbalancing that in different ways, we're starting to see that education or re-education of what these three branches of government do and, you know, how they affect change for you and I, et cetera. So I think that's a really salient point and something that we just can't be naive to anymore. We, you know, people bug out about San Francisco, you know, the homeless problems, the, you know, the growing inequalities, the lack of strong infrastructure. We've obviously got an education problem in the United States and everyone's pointing fingers. And I feel like they're pointing fingers so much at the wrong places. They need to sort of educate themselves on that. So thank you for that. You have been active, so I hear, because I have an Android and Bree has an Android. You have been active on Clubhouse. If you are talking to two blind people here in this scenario, tell us about Clubhouse. What is it to you?
So first off, I have an Android as well. Yeah. The reason I'm able to use Clubhouse is because I have an iPod.
Okay.
And I have an iPod Touch just because when I meet companies that are only on Apple devices, I need a way to try them out. So I got myself a cheap Apple device to be able to do so. Do not have an iPhone. Never have. Clubhouse is a fascinating app that has the ability to... Clubhouse is the voice version of Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
It has the ability to be extremely powerful and allow people to share and grab immense amounts of information and knowledge. It also has the ability to allow people who are bad actors to speak out, spread different disinformation, and also be very vile.
Mm.
And so here's my story about Clubhouse. The day I got on Clubhouse after ignoring it for months because I don't have room for any more ways for people to contact me. I don't have room for any more platforms, right?
Too many channels.
There's too many channels as there is, right? Like I can barely keep up with emails, let alone everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So I get on Clubhouse and I don't know what I'm doing. I see a room with a bunch of names of people I don't know. And it's a group of women who are talking about public speaking. And they do, and you know, public speaking as a profession and how you make money doing it. And as I get on, there was a guy who had just got finished reaming all the women, mostly black women, about how wrong they were to charge their prices and fees and they don't, you know, deserve to be doing that and how he does public speaking all the time and doesn't charge people, all this stuff. Mind you, these women do this professionally. Mm-hmm. This is what they do. They are experts in their field. And so he goes off on these women. And then the moderator proceeds to apologize to him. And all the black women in the group are telling the moderator to stop apologizing. You didn't do anything wrong. He was wrong.
Mm.
Cool. 3 minutes later, those black women leave that room and start another room to talk about the experience and how they felt when this man started talking to them. and the visceral reaction and the pain that these women felt from this man trying to tell them about what they do for a living and about how they shouldn't get paid for their knowledge. Like, the hurt that those women were feeling was mind-blowing. Juxtaposed with 15 minutes later, I start my own room for the first time. And it's nothing but a bunch of people congratulating me for joining the platform and then proceeding to tell stories about how I had empowered them and helped them. And how excited they were for me to be on the platform and to learn from me. That was my first day on Clubhouse. I very quickly got to see the power of it while also seeing how it can be tough, because it's hard to moderate. I've been on rooms where you've let people up on stage to talk and they start, and you don't know who everybody is, right, and they start to say things that can be hurtful and degrading. But then I've also been in rooms where Baron Davis, the former point guard, NBA basketball player, invites me in the room to talk about ownership and how do you invest and what do we look like to have ownership. And I'm in this room with Baron and Master P and E40 and these sportscasters and like these people. And that led to a gold medalist Olympian reaching out to me on Instagram to ask me for advice. Like, that's wild. Like, I was in a clubhouse with E40 and Master P talking about investing. Like, that's power. But that's also very similar to the way Twitter was. When Twitter first started, there was a lot of this high-level engaging content because it was limited. And as it opened up, there's still pockets of that content. And there will always be pockets of that content to this day. But then you also got people just spewing the most hateful stuff.
Yep.
And so it's a mixed bag. And so I think any social media platform that's meant to be open to the general public and left in the moderation is left open, you will always have room for things like that to happen. But I will say Clubhouse has real power. And Clubhouse is sucking up all the air, but there are going to be other players in the space. There are going to be other players that speak to other cultural relevance. And, you know, there's a lot of talk from, you know, a lot of Black people who say, hey, we're creating a lot of content on Clubhouse, but Clubhouse isn't Black owned. Black people aren't getting anything from this. How do we create a platform that is? And I think there will be platforms that are built that way. Does that make Clubhouse the worst thing ever? No, it doesn't. Does it make the folks who created Clubhouse horrible people? No, at their core, they're not terrible people. They didn't build Clubhouse to be a bad thing or to exploit anybody, right? But content creators and cultural drivers aren't always the same people who build the platforms that allow their expressions to be open.
Sure.
Right? And so without the platform, a lot of these people wouldn't be able to express or have these platforms or give this content, right? So you need the platform to give the content, and you need somebody who's going to build that. And if you're not going to build this, you can feel like you're being exploited, and to an extent you might be, but you also wouldn't even have this opportunity if they didn't build it, right? So there's got to be some give and take there.
Yeah.
And that's trying to be as fair as I can.
No, that's a great take. And I think something that Twitter is dealing with is, where is the line between free speech and hate speech? How do you moderate it? And how do you, I mean, that's a big ass problem, right? It's a, and it's really, you know, I think something that the Biden administration, going back to that, and all of the lawmakers are going to have to look at and get smarter, number one, about these platforms. Number two, kind of figure out what the best way is to regulate kind of speech in a way that doesn't remove kind of the beauty of having free speech in the first place.
Yeah, but you got to be careful with that, right? Because
publishers
are certain things that there are certain things that we know to be hateful.
Yep. Right?
And then there are certain things that can be deemed hateful that aren't. So to that extent, the term Black Lives Matter in some people's eyes is hate speech.
Yeah.
So how do you so like that's where it gets really complicated. Yeah, because humans are flawed and a lot of us have different views on things. And so what I may deem as hate speech, you may deem as patriotic. And what I deem as patriotic, you may deem as hate speech. And so who's going to tell either one of us who's right and who's wrong?
Right. And isn't that the platforms versus publisher argument? And so like, are they platforms or are they publishers? And I think this even goes to your content ownership question, Mac, because, you know, if they're not owning the platform and it's a platform that should be neutral, but if it's a publisher, right, then they do own the content. It gets very murky right now. This is a really, I think, murky situation.
Yeah. So that's what makes these things hard, right? Yeah. Like, you know, people want to be mad at folks who have different political views, right? But everybody has their own experiences and grew up differently. And what it means to be one thing to one person is very different than what it means to somebody else. What it means to be poor in the Midwest, where your father has to go grab a gun and go hunt for food because you can't afford food, it's very different than what it means to be poor in Baltimore City, where the idea of grabbing a gun and going hunting for food doesn't exist.
Right.
But if you told that young person from the Midwest who's going to tell you he grew up poor, you cannot tell him that his poor is different than somebody else's.
Sure.
Even though it may be. And like those are where the complications really come into play. And that's where these things get hard. And that's where the idea of empathy and walking in somebody's else's shoes is needed. But that's hard to do. Like we say it all the time, right? But we just say it. But to actually do it,
right?
To actually experience it, like it's like you don't know what it is to be homeless and eat out of a trash can at a McDonald's until you've done it. Right. And you don't understand what the scenario is to be homeless and living out of a car with your three kids, but still having a job and be like, well, you just mismanaged your money. What do you like? You don't understand the scenarios that led to that. You also don't know what it's like to be somebody who grows up in the city where, or comes up in the family where by the time you're 10, your credit's messed up because your parents have used it.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard. Like, we can all say these things, but to actually truly empathize for it is a whole nother thing. And it's really hard to do. And that's what makes all these things so damn complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know when it was in the United States where this possibility and where discourse and differences became so much of a zero-sum game, right? Where I have this and therefore you can't have this, right? I don't know when it became all about shouting loudest, right? And the person who shouted the loudest was going to win. And we seem to have lost a lot of the empathy that has guided this country to becoming the melting pot that it is somewhere. And, you know, my hope amongst hopes, and this is our conversation on January 6th, and this goes back to when we first met, was, you know, not everyone that voted for the other side is evil inherently. And so I do really hope that, you know, we're able to try and find out what real discourse is in this country again, and to talk with one another with empathy. And not judge each other so quickly and not think that this game is so zero sum, right? In every world, you know, Mac, just because you raised X amount of money doesn't mean that there's X less money for me. Right. And I think that's a mentality that we need to get away from, not only in the US, but specifically talking about the venture community. You know, we are so humbled to have you on this show. So thank you so much. I'm gonna rattle off a few names, and okay. Here they are. Okay, Earl Graves, Willie Lanier, Len Ford, Kip Ward, Mesa Leek, Rochelle Stevens, Kevin Frazier, Monique, Perrin Mitchell. Can you tell me what those names have in common?
They all comedians?
No. In fact, Earl Graves was the founder of Black Entertainment Magazine. Willie Lanier, Len Ford, a few others that I mentioned were NFL Hall of Famers. Mesa Leek was a jazz musicianist. Rochelle Stevens, Olympic gold medalist. Kevin Frazier is an ESPN analyst. And what they all have in common is they went to Morgan State University. And I'm not a betting man by any means, but if I was a betting man, I'd bet that in the next decade, you'll be amongst those names. And we really appreciate your time. You know, McKeever, Mac, Conwell, thanks so much. We typically ask you to open up the vest at this point and try it on, but seeing that the Fed's already got to that, and we've already talked about it, you know, it'd be great if you could sign us out the way that we ask every guest to sign us out, just give us a toast to 2021. It is your 30 seconds to promote a company, to promote the fund, to do whatever you want. It's all yours.
So a toast to Rare Breed Ventures. We are a 506c fund, which means I can publicly solicit. So at Rare Breed, we are raising a $10 million fund. If you are an accredited investor, our minimum LP check is still 10K. It will be going up sometime in April. So if you want to get in, go to rarebreed.vc. There's a button you can click on to become an LP. Join us on this journey. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.